UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network. We're your hosts. Take a look at movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me today is the man, my nemesis, the man who's trying to get the same bounty as me. But you know what? Let's work together instead. Zach Moore.
So, Brandon, I'm very excited to talk about A Fistful of Dollars 2, The Mandalorian today.
The Mandalorian. Yeah, they're bounty hunters. It works for me. Bubba Joe.
All right, let's move on and introduce our guest, Mr. Tom Elliott. He's been with us every film so far in this franchise from the Twilight Zone podcast. You know him, you love him. What's up, Tom? Thanks for joining us.
Gentlemen, it's been a while. It's good to speak to you again. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Right on. I love it. Yes, we are looking forward to discussing this one here, the next movie in the Man with No Name trilogy, I guess. But Zach, we've got some interesting trivia on this film, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, he has a second name already. So Man with No Name, again, is a very bad description. I don't know who came up with this moniker for this trilogy. We can end that. Monko is his name. So if you really want to, you know, use some headcanon, you can say his name is Joe Monko, if you really like. Because, you know, the thing about...
I completely missed that. I missed Joe in the first one, as we were talking last episode.
Do you even watch these movies, Brandon, that we talk about? Yeah. So if you think back to Yojimbo and Sanjiro, there's actually, like, there's a scene, there's a line where, like, hey, what's your name anyway? He's like, my name is... And he looks around and he comes up with a name. There's none of that here. People just drop names for Man with No Name. Like, it'd be one thing if he's inventing the names of people. It's fun. But we get into it, because that's actually part of the trivia of why he has multiple names. So if you want, we can just dive headfirst into this stuff.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So in classic Fistful of Dollars fashion, this was delayed a couple years. It was filmed in 1965, but not released in the U.S. until 1967. So we had that going for it. And interesting, like Kurosawa with Yojimbo and Sanjuro, Sergio Leone, he didn't want to make a follow-up to Fistful of Dollars. He felt the franchise was fatigued, much like Brandon Shea Mutella. So... but it was such a huge hit that the production company, Jolly Film, refused to pay Leone what was owed to him from the first movie unless he did a second movie. So they kind of held him hostage there, and that's when we got a follow-up. And, you know, and this is a common theme for Leone here with breaking the rules of 1960s Hollywood and the conventions, kind of, you know, because he just didn't know any better. And like talking about like traditionally, you know, in Hollywood films, when you have like a shootout, you'd see the person with the gun shoot, and you cut to the person getting shot, and you cut back. But in these films, he's actually, you know, following Clint Eastwood with the camera, seeing the people get shot and blown away, as if you're kind of over Eastwood's shoulder. So that's its own kind of approach. But then also, you know, horses being gunned down—that was something you didn't see in a lot of westerns. You know, animal cruelty. You know.
Yeah, I remember that from the last movie there when the guy had the machine gun going off and all those people were falling, but he kept missing the horses. Like, that's a pretty epic aim that he had in the last movie.
Well,
he was able to miss the horses.
And then notice there's no blood in that either, because it's just people. I mean, obviously it's like, all right, go. And the people are just jumping off horses, acting like they're falling. There's no squibs or anything. You know, it's a low budget. But, you know, I appreciate the lack of gore and blood, at least in a film like this. But also, you know, marijuana use and a rape scene, which there is in this film as well, so we can get into that. But these are like things you would never, ever, ever see in an American film in the 1960s. So, now the man with no name, as we said, his name is Monko in this film, and his name was Joe in A Fistful of Dollars. Now, this is why it's like this. So, the finding of an Italian court that settled the lawsuit brought by Jolly Films, which is a producer of Fistful of Dollars. After release of the movie, Sergio Leone had a falling out with them, because they wouldn't pay him, you know. They made this movie with a different producer, Alberto Grimaldi. So Jolly Films sued, and they claimed ownership of the, quote, Joe character, but lost when the court decided that the Western's gunfighter persona, which was characterized by the costume and the mannerisms, belonged in the public domain's folklore. And you can't, like, copyright, like, a cowboy archetype, which is basically what they were trying to do. So Clint Eastwood, you know, wearing the same thing, you know, which also ties it together. His poncho, it was never washed during the production of the first film, or even any of these films, actually. But it was mended in the final scene, obviously the last film. His poncho gets pierced by all the bullets from one of the Ramone brothers. And in this movie, he's wearing the same poncho back to front. And the mending of the bullet holes are clearly visible on the back in several scenes. And in the original area, it was over his the left part of his chest, but now it's over his right shoulder blade. So he just turned it around, which is, you know, if I was a cowboy and I got shot a lot, I would just flip it around and it'd look normal. So I think that's a very efficient thing to do. And that, you know, that green poncho is like his look. So that is character continuity. But, I mean, it's called the Man with No Name trilogy just because there was a lawsuit after the first film. They wanted to keep using the character. I mean, that's basically what it is. So sorry to ruin the mystery of the character, guys. That's why. So, now, speaking of characters, we have Lee Van Cleef in this film. He's kind of the co-lead, really. And, you know, Eastwood calls him old man, and Lee Van Cleef calls him, you know, boy. But there were only a five-year age difference between the guys. So, you know, it's one of those classic Indiana Jones... Sean Connery's 12 years older than Harrison Ford, but he's his dad thing going on with these two guys. Now, so Sergio Leone, once again, he wanted Henry Fonda to be in this film. He'd wanted him to be in the first film. He wanted to be in this one. He wanted him to play the role of Douglas Mortimer, which was Lee Van Cleef's character, but Fonda turned it down. Charles Bronson was approached again, not interested. You know, so he's got better things to do, apparently. Lee Marvin was approached, but he turned it down because he had just signed on to make another film, Cat Ballou. And then Leone offered it to Lee Van Cleef, who hadn't worked in the movies in a few years since How the West Was Won, although he worked pretty steadily in television. Yeah, appeared in an episode of The Twilight Zone. Isn't that right, Tom?
That's right. So Western, too.
Western, that's right. With Lee Marvin, so there's a lot of crossover between all these guys going on. But Van Cleef, he kind of fell into some alcoholism and had some, you know, that's but hurt his career. So this really did help, and he was very grateful he got this part because he'd fallen into hard times in his career-wise. And this effectively marked a resurgence in his career. But in the meantime, he had actually taken up painting in the interim as a way to make money when he was getting acting roles, which, you know, all creative types. You know, he got all kinds of creative outlets there. One other actor who was considered for Mortimer, and I would have loved this, was Jack Palance. You know, you might know him from City Slickers or Batman 89, but he was, you know, Shane. Okay. I mean, talking about Westerns, right? Isn't that? But he would have been a great presence as well. I love Jack Palance, big Jack Palance fan. So Lee Van Cleef claimed that he was a faster draw of the gun than Clint Eastwood. It took him 3 frames of film, which equates to 1/8 of a second to draw, cock, and fire. So I don't know if they actually got, like, I don't know if they had a contest or what, but Lee Van Cleef thought he was better than Clint Eastwood. Now, talk about, we can talk about this. There are lots of recurring actors in this franchise. And Gian Maria Volante, he was the main villain in the first film. He's also the main villain in this film. So that's something else that, you know, Jimbo and Sanjuro have in common with the Man with No Name trilogy. Like, let's just have all the same actors play very similar characters in both movies, right? So, yeah, like, because the one of the side villains in the first film becomes the main villain in the second film, et cetera, vice versa. But in the first A Fistful of Dollars, Gian Maria Volante, he did perform his own voice for the English translator. However, he did need a he performed his own voice for the English language version, but he did need a translator to tell him everything word for word. So he did not know any English. So
I wonder if Italy had the same kind of thing, because, like, this boils down to, you know, like, the Japanese films were done by a studio, and, you know, movie making back in this day, even in the States, were done by studio production. They would hire a person, they would get a salary for a year, and they would just make as many movies as they were scheduled to. Like, nowadays, actors are contract-based. You're like, you get paid this much money to do this movie, and then you're out of work until you get your next film. And in this day and age, people would just be hired on for a studio, and they'd be like, okay, today you're working on this film, tomorrow you're working on that film, you know. And we mentioned it briefly at the end of the last one. I'm going through the Godzilla movies right now, and some of the bonus features for the Godzilla set, they're talking about on Toho Studios, and one of the guys is like, yep, I was on this one this day, and this one this day, working with all these different people. And it was just, it was a different type of production, and I wonder if Italy might have had that same thing, where it's like, we got a set of actors that just work on our movies, and we need you on this set this day, kind of thing.
Well, the studio system, you know, it was even in Hollywood in that day and age, you know.
Yep.
Which, you know, until like the 70s is when things really, the new wave of Hollywood cinema in the 70s kind of shook things up. But yeah, I mean, you just have people on retainer, like, all right, you're going to get this, this, that. And that's why you see all these familiar faces over and over again. And people, again, this is the 60s. People aren't thinking like 50 years later, some guy's going to sit around podcasting about, why is this the same guy? Playing this character, he died in the last film. So, but here we are, right? So, but speaking of Vellante, it's funny, you know, Sergio Leone, he kind of had the Nicholas Meyer to William Shatner approach in Star Trek 2 here with Vellante as the villain, because Leone felt that he was sometimes too theatrical as Indio, his character in this film. And so, what Leone would do is he would do take after take after take to try to kind of wear him out. And then Vellante became so angry with this, because he kind of caught on to what was going on at some point, he eventually stormed off the set. But, you know, they're filming in the middle of the desert, and he really couldn't get a ride anywhere, so he came back, but he swore he would never make another Western, because he was sick of this this kind of treatment. Which I think, it's like they're going to catch on at some point. But yeah, as the story goes, Nicholas Meyer did the same thing to William Shatner in Star Trek 2, the one scene everybody talks
here
about.
Here it comes.
Yeah, you know, it's like when Khan's like supposed to get the prefix go for the Reliant, Shatner kept going like, here it comes, here it comes, here it comes, here it comes.
Here it
like,
comes.
The 20th take or something, he was just like, here it comes. And it's like, you don't want to telegraph to the villain. So it's interesting to hear that about the guy here. Because I think, and perhaps because of Leone's direction, I think Vellante does a better job in this film than he did in the first film, his character as the main villain. So, now, talking about recurring actors, Mario Brega, he appeared in all three movies in the Dollar Trilogy. In the first film, he was Chico. He got killed by the giant barrel. In this film, he's Nino, and he gets stabbed in the back by a fellow member of Indigo's gang. He's kind of like the Paul Roach of the Indiana Jones movies. You know, he's like the guy that gets killed in brutal ways in each film. He gets killed by the propeller in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he gets crushed by the conveyor belt of the rocks in the second one. And he was actually supposed to be in Last Crusade, but they cut a scene. But anyway, that reminded me of that guy dying in these horrific ways in each film. And Ennio Morricone, again, he wrote the score before production started, and that's what Sergio Leone actually had asked him to do. And Leone would often shoot to the music on set, which is a very unique approach. But again, they didn't record any audio, so you can get away with that. You know, you think about movies, and you're like, whenever there's like a dance scene, you know, like, you know, we did The Terminator a couple franchises ago. Whenever there's like a dance scene in there, right, when Terminator comes to kill Sarah Connor, when they film that, there's no music. You know, people are just moving around. Like, that is the most surreal thing to experience, to see a movie set where they're like, all this music and sound effects is going on, but there's no actual music going on there. So, but you can get away with stuff like that by like, hey, this is going to be the score, guys. We're going to play it as we film it. So I think that's just a very interesting, unique approach. Now, again, Clint Eastwood did do his ADR, and Lee Van Cleef did so as well. So both of them, the main stars of the film, did their audio, as did Gian Maria Vellante. So the main characters here did. And as we were talking about in our Fistful of Dollars podcast, you know, I mean, when you don't know what the other people's voices really are, it's not that distracting. So, you know, I think it doesn't really take away from anything. It does add to a bit of charm there. And then also when they
on the last movie, that kid sure did not sound quite right in the last movie.
The kid was kind of weak. I'm not going to lie. Yeah, the mama, mama. You know, that was a little rough. That was like some, you know, Rocky Bullwinkle kind of dialogue going on there. But
Bewitching Pool.
Yes, exactly. To bring it on to the Twilight Zone, the voice of Rocky the Bullwinkle. Rocky the Flying Squirrel. So there is one last bit of trivia to discuss, and it's about several scenes that were shot, but no one really knows if they were shown in any version of the movie. You know, we have these international movies, no one's really sure, like, okay, what market got this or that, or what was shown where. And some of the scenes include Clint Eastwood Manco as he's named in this film. He was looking at the reward poster for Red Kavanaugh and later taking the poster of El Indio off a wall. And then when El Indio has broken out of jail, he baptizes his gun. And then he also sleeps with the hotel manager's wife in El Paso. And then Manco shoots three of El Indio's men by a river. And then that was transposed into a desert setting instead. And then in another area, Indio and his gang relax with some women from the village. And in 1967, they actually edited out and censored El Indio's scene where he rapes Lee Van Cleef's sister. And then also her suicide. So they took that out of the film. That was restored for home video releases on DVD and Blu-ray. So, I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. That's a super intense scene that kind of really surprised me for a film from especially the 1960s, which had been just going right along like a normal Western up till then. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's your trivia for a few dollars more.
Excellent. Good job. So I started it off last time. I'll start it off again. Can you guys guess as to the weird editing thing I might be bringing up in this one?
No.
No, like that.
I thought there were more fades to black in this. Like, for a few dollars, we'll return after this commercial break from our sponsors. Like, that's what I kept zeroing on. But what did you find here, Brandon?
Okay, that one scene with Lee Van Cleef's character, and they had, like, there was, like, bullets going off or whatever, and there was, like, just that rapid, really bizarre editing going, like, I'm like, what is happening here right now, and why are they doing this?
Is that when he's shooting the hat?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's...
I think that's what it was, yeah.
Well, you know, that's kind of punches up the moment of... All you have is a hat being shot in the sky. So, but
No, it wasn't the hat. It wasn't the hat sequence. Okay. That scene was really cool. I can't remember. You know what? Okay, so I can't remember exactly what was going on, but there was this weird thing going on where there was this really, really rapid thing, and there was these gunshot sounds going on as this rapid editing was happening. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of threw me out.
I think I know what you're talking about. I do.
Yeah, it wasn't the hat sequence though. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, anyways, the flashbacks were kind of odd too, I thought. I mean, I understand why they're there narratively, but just the placement of them mm-hmm. was like, we have, it's like the only flashbacks in either of these movies so far, and I'm like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Twist! Here's the big reveal of the villain's secret origin or something, so anyway.
Registry. Had I not known that this was a sequel, I wouldn't have known that this was a sequel had I just gone and watched this, because Eastwood's character did not really feel like the same character to me. What do you guys think about that? Tom?
I mean, this is endlessly fascinating to me with these movies. How are they actually sequels, or is it just like, Clint, we're making another West, and yeah, you still got that suit, just bring it, you know? And is that what it really is? Because we have the stuff with the actors who you'd spoke about, and there's more. There's like a guy called Luigi Pastilli, who I think is in all three, or at least he's in this one and the next one too. And then what Lee Van Cleef is in the next one is a completely different character, which is strange for such a huge part. Mm-hmm. So the man with no name himself, I just felt that Eastwood was more assured in this one. I think he was just a bit, he's still very internal, but he just felt a bit more confident to me.
He felt like a darker character to me than he did in the last one.
Possibly, but I guess he's in... Is he in a worse situation? I don't know, but he's really at the heart of stuff. In the last one, he's sort of playing people off each other till the end. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'll have to think about that one. It's an interesting point, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't take away from me, but to me, it just didn't feel like the same character as I was watching it. The fact that he was actively pursuing a bounty, you know, like, I guess I was putting a lot of Mifune's character onto him in the first one, and a lot of Mifune's motivation in the first one, where it didn't feel like Mifune was in it for the money. So to me, it didn't feel like Eastwood was in it for the money in the first one, right? He was just there. He's like, I'm looking for the good end result of this. And to keep them off their toes, I'm asking for money, right? Is mm-hmm. kind of the motivation that I put on the first film. And in this one, he's a bounty hunter looking for people to kill them, to get a bounty on them. So to me, I don't know. So right off the bat, it just felt like a different character to me.
Yeah, there's nothing that happened in the first film that kind of informs the character in this film. And you're right, he's not like just drifting through town to see what happens. He is a bounty hunter on a mission in this one. And I'm like, I don't know when he fell into that life. But, you know, I think a twist right off the top is, you know, the movie starts and I don't know, I haven't seen any of these before. And I'm like, oh, well, here comes Clint Eastwood on his horse, you know. And then this person just gets shot. And it's like, there's a title card. It is an age of bounty hunters. And that's what made me think of The Mandalorian, because they make such a big deal out of how this is. And I know there's bounty hunters. It's not a Star Wars exclusive thing. I'm just saying it's hot right now. It's on everybody's mind in the zeitgeist. But I'm like, oh, this is just an example of how people just get shot on the road out there. So, yeah, I think that was a nice subversion of expectations, because I thought, oh, here comes Clint. He's riding in. Nope, that's just a random guy who gets shot. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's a... This is not a remake of Sanjuro, okay? So let's get that clear. They didn't be like, all right, well, what's next, right? They actually had the original idea. And, you know, the Lee Van Cleef character and the dynamics between him and the Clint Eastwood character are great. And I think that kind of, they're two different, like Lee Van Cleef, he's very polished. He has different technology and all this. And Clint Eastwood, he's just so rough and tumble, kind of down and dirty, simple. Both very different approaches, but very effective techniques as well. So I think, and then one's older, one's younger. So playing those off each other, and then are they working together? Are they not? Like, that's a good angle to do something different with the character we saw in the first film. So I think that was definitely a plus here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I loved Lee Van Cleef's character and all like the weapons that he had. I thought that was really an interesting character trait to have and bring something unique to this movie. You know, he's whipping out all these long guns. I'm thinking the Joker from Batman 1989 shooting down the Batplane, you know, things like that. So anyways, I thought that was really cool. So Tom, tell us about this one here, because you love this one a lot more than the...
I've got to say that the Lee Van Cleef factor really plays into this one for me. I love this guy. Mm-hmm. And it's also the part of my fascination with just how things worked back then. Again, we've got a guy, like you were saying in the trivia, Zach, who sort of, you know, fell out a bit in the business in America. He worked a lot in TV. Like, that Twilight Zone he's in, he's not even like the main character. He's just one of the guys sitting in the bar and he's got a couple of lines or whatever. But then he comes to Italy and he becomes a big star in Italy. Like, he'd done the two Sergio Leone movies, and there's a whole bunch of spaghetti westerns where he's actually the main lead in them as well. Day of Anger is one off the top of my head. So there's just something about him that I absolutely love. He's like a hawk, you know, those hooked sort of facial figure features. But he's just got such presence as well. So... It's you know, with, again, if we're comparing it to the Yojimbo movies, you guys liked Sanjuro a bit more than me. And I wonder, this one has a bit of an advantage because it just adds another fascinating character into the mix. Mm-hmm. What would Sanjuro have been like if there's another samurai comes along who's got a different sort of way of working and that kind of thing? So Lee Van Cleef just adds so much to this movie for me, and I really do love him as an actor and a character in it.
You know, we talk about these actors in different roles, and like you're saying, like, it's just another cowboy movie with Clint Eastwood. It's the same kind of thing where it's like, you know, in some people's headcanon, like Air Force One with Harrison Ford is like President Jack Ryan. It's that kind of thing. It's like, it's funny. I mean, nowadays everything's so franchised and stuff, but back in the day, you could kind of connect your own dots and that kind of thing. Same with like Yojimbo and Sanjuro. There are, like, you know, we had mentioned there are other samurai movies that Shino Fumifune stars in. You're like, is that him with just under a different name? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But that's part of the, you know, it is part of the fun, like connecting these dots, mm-hmm. having your head canon about like, which movies am I going to watch in this series? But these really are episodic movies. Like you're saying, like, there's nothing to say this one needs to take place before or after the last one. But yeah, I think, you know, Clint Eastwood,
other than the holes in the thing in the back there.
Very true. Very true. got me there, Brandon. But, you know, the thing about Clint Eastwood is the last film was his first starring role. So they're probably like, all right, we don't want to give this guy too much. Just be the strong, stoic, quiet type. Maybe smile sometimes if you're having a good time, Clint, but don't do much else. This time he gets more dialogue. He gets more to do. Probably had more faith in him as a leading man when they had seen what he had done with the first film and had been very successful. So,
Yeah, right on. I want to talk about my favorite scene in the movie, and my favorite scene we've already touched on a little bit was the hat shooting scene. Mm-hmm. I really loved that scene a lot, and I thought it really set up both characters right off the bat. You know, because, you know, Eastwood's trying to, you know, tick this other guy off, right? Because they're going after the same kind of bounty, and they're both the same kind of people.
Well, he sends a random Asian man to come pack up all his things and take him to the train station. I was like, what is this? Who is this guy? Just came to call his stuff, and that's what leads to this confrontation, because he wants to get him out of town so he can get the bounty.
Yes. Well, I assume that was like the owner of the establishment where he was like renting or something.
It was just very odd. Yes. But anyway.
Go to the station. No, stay here and whatnot.
And the guy's like, whatever. And he eventually just drops the stuff. Since you guys figure it out.
Yeah, it was a really interesting scene. And then so, you know, Eastwood, he's a great shot. He keeps shooting the hat off. And Lee Van Cleef's character, he's like, you know what? Okay, I'm going to test this out and play this out. And he gets to a point where he's now out of his range, and then he whips out his big long gun and turns the tables on him, right?
Shoots
and
it off his head.
Yeah.
Into the sky. And keep... Now, are their hats full of holes now, right? I mean, shouldn't they be?
No, it just dinged it in the right way, so it just bounced off the bullet. That's how like, good he was.
Both of their hats should be like Swiss cheese in the second half of this film, after this scene, but...
No, because he kept shooting underneath the hat on the ground. Okay. It just kept on hit the sand and shot it up in the air.
Very good. So.
I also love the scene with the Klaus Kinski character in the bar, with the smoking scene, you know, and it's all just about domination, isn't it? And posturing and like, you know, I drink your milkshake kind of stuff. It's like, but yeah, the sort of like, okay, I'm going to light my thing off your thing. I'm going to blow your match out. I'm going to do this. And then there's the hat scene later on. So this was before the plot really kicks in, but I just love all this. Everyone's sizing each other up. Everyone's sort of posturing and seeing how they can get one over on everyone else.
Yeah, that was a great scene.
You know, you mentioned the plot kicking in, and I will say I felt this was kind of long. It was over 2 hours, which, I mean, sounds like an absurd criticism, but most of these other ones have been, you know, other ones in this quote-unquote franchise, this loose franchise, they've been under 2 hours, and moved along at a brisk pace. There wasn't any kind of like slow moment. I did feel like this movie dragged in some places, because I'm like, all right, so where's this going? Like, you know, I know eventually these two bounty hunters are going to like encounter each other, and that's great. But then like, what is the villain's plot? What is this random flashback? Why does he have this pocket watch that's going to be a big reveal in like 2 hours? Did you guys feel that it dragged at all, or did it feel just right to you?
With my first time watch, no, it felt just right to me. I really liked it and how they were building the characters and whatnot. I found it really fascinating. A really fascinating story, and the subtle things that really stuck out, like you just mentioned, was the watch. Like, I'm like, it's a really neat character trait. And while these things are taking time, to me, it really added to the characters, where he kept opening that watch and that song would play, and he's like, okay, when this song is done, we're going to draw our weapons. You know, it was just like an interesting character trait, which yes, it filled up the time a little bit, but it added something to these characters for me.
Mm. I think it's funny, really, that the last movie was shorter, but I felt that one dragged a bit for me. Mm-hmm. This one, I'm quite happy with. It's because it just gets more and more interesting as it goes. And if it is a slow moment, I'm just enjoying Lee Van Cleef do his thing. I'm just enjoying Clint Eastwood do his thing and just whatever interaction they have. And so there's always something that keeps me interested as the plot really starts to roll.
Yeah, Lee Van Cleef, he has that rivalry with the Hunchback character that eventually comes back to bite him at the end, or at least that character, right? Why would you pick a fight with Lee Van Cleef? That guy is a badass-looking guy, and I'm just going to keep to myself. Like, he wants to drink my milkshake, like you were saying, I'm just going to let him, because that guy is really cool. You know, a side character I liked was the old man that Clint Eastwood goes and talks to for a while. I don't know if that's the same guy who was the Undertaker in the first film. It looked like him. I think it might have been just an old, like a crazy old looking guy with a beard. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of those out there. But that was just a very enjoyable scene. Like, that was just a, you know, one-off character. He's like, you know everybody. Come on, tell me. Oh, did he wear his gun on his belly? Why didn't you tell me that? You know, I told him I'm not going to sell my land to the train factory. And then, of course, whenever a train goes by, everything shakes and there's smoke everywhere. It's a nice levity in what's a pretty heavy heavy film for the most part. So I enjoyed the bit characters and especially that guy.
Well, there's the wife as well in the hotel. Those scenes where she's sort of, you know, clearly lusting after Clint Eastwood, and she's like, he's so tall, and then her husband sort of steps off a step that he was on behind the counter, and he's like really short. So yeah, it is quite funny in moments.
Yeah, see that, and again, like for me, that humor felt a little bit weird to me. Because the last movie and this one had been pretty serious, and then all of a sudden you get this weird moment of this woman who's just like clearly feels dissatisfied with her husband, right? And I don't know, it just felt that to me felt like a weird scene. Like it didn't take away, but it felt very strange to me to have that comedic moment where he just steps down and he's so much shorter than her and everything like that. I don't know, just felt a little odd. So,
what did you guys think of the hidden safe in the Bank of El Paso, which is it's inside the cabinet. No one will ever suspect that it's here.
Well, that whole sequence was really interesting, right? Where, you know, they timed, they're like, they're watching, they're timing it out. How long does it take these security guards to go around the building? Mm-hmm. And it completely diverts you because you think that they're going to like run in the building from the front door when nobody's around. And then they just blow out the back of the building, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to me, it was unexpected. But I don't know, like it's obviously something where had you not known it was there, nobody would have ever known. So clearly this information got spilt somewhere along the way. Somebody spilt the beans on where this safe actually was, you know?
Yeah, that was the cellmate who gets murdered. He has this white box, you know, and everybody's like, what's this white box? And then eventually we get I love the scene of the bad guys like who are hiding out in some church that's like either abandoned or under construction. And then he like gets in the pulpit to like tell them his evil plan. You know, I was like, that's pretty smart. I don't know why. Maybe they just had this set. I don't know, but it was enjoyable. It was more interesting than just guys sitting around on the floor. It was like, I'm going to get in this pulpit and tell you what our master plan is. And that's when you find out, like, you know, he designed this safe and it was a cabinet and that's his miniature. And anyway, that's our exposition. But it was a very entertaining way to communicate that exposition, I think. Mm-hmm. And okay, so correct me if I'm wrong. Was there not a couple of shots in this film where Clint Eastwood is in blackface?
I must have missed it.
Okay, like it's when he's going into one of these hideouts, I don't know which, and Lee Van Cleef is in there, but it's really dark, and you see Clint Eastwood on the roof, and he looks like he does in the rest of the movie, and then you see him like go into this dark room, and I think what they were trying to do was communicate that, hey, it's really dark in here. And so they like made his face like literally like black. And then,
I didn't catch it. I missed it. If they did, but that's what it would have been because these were all filmed as day for night, right?
Well, no, actually, and, you know, this one was not. The first one was. There was a lot of day for night in the first one, but this one there's a lot of just night for night. they had a budget now. But I was like, I've never thought about that, and that's a kind of finicky thing, I guess, especially in this day and age. But look in the middle of the movie, Lee Van Cleef kind of turns on a candle. What a stupid thing to say. He lights a candle, some kind of match, and then you see Clint Eastwood and he's fine. But I think there's a couple shots in there where they tried something, you know? And I'm like, all right, you tried something, Spaghetti Western. Good for you. That was just like, I actually rewound it because I was like, that is bizarre. What is going on here? Did I miss something? Is he hiding? Is it Arnold Schwarzenegger Predator style? Is he covered in mud trying to hide from somebody? That was not the case. But anyway.
Yeah, those Italian Mexicans sure got the infrared, you know,
the
down
infrared
pats.
Yeah, I love at the end of that. I think it's the scene you're talking about where they climb off the roof, and then the bad guys are sort of they step on the shoulder of like Indio and stuff like that, because it's the thing throughout these movies, isn't it? The things don't always go to plan, you know, and it's what they then do next that's enjoyable. How are they going to get out of this one? And it's even made even more enjoyable because Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef just have a very uneasy alliance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not going to kill each other, but if I can get away with the money, then I'm going to do it, and I'm going to say I'm going to go this way, but I'm actually going this way. So that adds an extra layer to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really fascinating. I love that when he steps down and he steps on the guy's shoulder, and then he quickly thinks to throw the bag away,
right,
and hide it in the tree so that they can't find it. But it is an interesting, because that's a good way to take the tension to the next level. Is that you got these two Western bounty hunters who are working together, but still nemesis, still enemies of each other. They're like, we got to work together to solve this because it's not a one-man job, but I don't trust you.
And they had their moment of bonding, you know, with the hat shooting. You know,
with the hat, yeah.
You know, that's, you know, we get all that. And at the end, they're kind of sharing a drink, talking about everything, you know, and I think that was an important kind of turn for the for them to be like, all right, they're working out the specifics of the deal, like, oh, he's worth 10,000 if I get four of those guys and that kind of thing. And then ultimately, at the end, you know, we find out that it really wasn't even about the money for Lee Van Cleef. It's about revenge for his sister's death. And he lets Joe, whatever his name is in this movie, take all the money. So let's talk about this. That was
40-year-old Mulberry Joe.
Yeah. So that was a very intense, unexpected thing to see in this film, like the rape suicide scene. Do we have thoughts on it, guys?
You're right, and I think that's why I kind of love the Italian stuff around this time. I know I keep bringing it up, but with the horror movies too, I think even by this point in America and probably whatever England were bringing out as well, things do become formulaic. And, okay, you got to have three acts, you got to have a love interest, blah, blah, blah. Whereas the Italians at this time were just so experimental and they didn't really care about whether things were too violent or too shocking. They just went with it and they just did it. And that's why I love it, because you never know where their movies are going to go. Whereas even now, most movies, you can kind of see how it's going to end up. You know what I mean? But with the Italians, they were just doing whatever they wanted. But I think I said last time round that I didn't feel like Sergio Leone had really arrived yet. He was still kind of getting his stuff together. I think this time he was a bit more confident as well. So he was trying new stuff. He was trying, you know, these crazy editing techniques. Even the shot of the guy on the horse at the beginning who sort of goes across and it's like, bang, then he's gone. It's just all about subverting expectations. So yeah, it was a shocking scene, and then she ends up killing herself. Mm-hmm. So
at the time, I guess I didn't really realize the importance of it, like you're bringing up here, Zach, but I think maybe that's part of the reason why these are so culturally relevant and so important as the spaghetti western, is because they were doing things that they couldn't do in Hollywood, you know, and people longed for that. But the, you know, the MPA code, right, wouldn't allow this kind of filmmaking to happen at that time. So that's probably part of the appeal that viewers had for these films.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly would have got a, you know, an X rating or something in America. And that's why they, you know, they cut it out of a lot of scenes and stuff. So, but it's more authentic too, because this is the Wild West. You know, some horrible things happen back there. These are villains. These are terrible people. So. And you know that the Indio, right, his character, he's a lot more well defined and fleshed out than that actor, same character from the previous film, where he was just like the ringleader of the brothers, basically, in that film. Or this one, like, he's got a plan, he has a history with some of the characters, he's done some bad stuff. I mean, he straight up murders this entire family, you know, when he first gets out of jail, because it's like the guy that sold him out to, you know, put him in jail in the first place. Like he brings the wife and baby into, you know, and then they take him outside and we hear them get shot and then he kills the guy. I'm like, this guy is hardcore across the board here. So yeah, just a despicable villain. And we love to see him get his comeuppance at the end.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. This is a really well done film, and it, while I say that it felt different than the last one and doesn't feel like the same character, like that, I think that almost makes it a better movie. That's part of the reason why it's a better movie, is because it's trying to be its own thing and it's not trying to, you know, remake something that's come before. And I really like that. I like that a lot. So, Tom, is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
I don't think so. I really enjoyed this watch though. It's been a while since I've seen it, and I forgot, maybe I like it more than I used to, or I just forgot how much I enjoyed it. I really feel like things are starting to come together. The music is a lot better. This is a lot more recognizable as a Morricone sort of score. And it's like, okay, everyone's saying, it's almost as if the first one was a test run. Yeah. And this is it, like, okay, we know what we're doing now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Zach, anything else you want to address here?
No, I think we covered it. So I do want to ask you guys, how many money exchanges do you think took place over the course of this film?
Tom?
God, I'm just plucking numbers out of the air now. I'll go with 8.
Okay, 8 for Tom. What about you, Brennan?
Yeah, I didn't keep track like I did the last one here. I didn't get a chance to watch it a second time, which is generally when I grab that kind of info. So I'm going to say 6.
Okay, so I came up with 5 or 6. So I want to ask y'all's opinion as I go down the list here. So we have the first one being when Lee Van Cleef gets the $1,000 for his bounty.
Yep.
Then we have, this is the one that's in question. Clint Eastwood wins the poker game. But we don't see him take that money, but he won the poker game, so he would have taken all that money. Which, that was an interesting scene where he just goes in there and cuts into the poker game. So that would be number 2. And then number 3 would him be winning the $2,000 for the bounty on those guys. So that's 3. And then number 4 is when he starts giving that kid change to give him some informant information. And then number 5 is when he meets up with the kid again. And he gives the kid more money for informant information. And then the 6th one is when they empty out the safe and get the money out of it. So that would be the 6th one from this film. And I don't think I missed any, unless you guys can remember anything that I forgot.
That works for me. I trust your judgment.
So that brings us 6 plus 12 is 18 money exchanges so far in these 4 movies of the franchise.
Like the death count in the Freddy films, the money exchanges just keep going up.
That's correct. So
with each sequel. Excellent. Now, how about a rating? How many dollars would you give this, Tom?
Man, I've agonized a little bit about this one because I gave Yojimbo 4 because I knew that I was going to like a movie that was coming up better, so that would be the 5 stars. But
you can give more than one movie 5 stars, Tom. It's okay.
I know, but I was sort of ranking them almost in my head. Yes. Maybe I'll, yeah. But I got to go
retroactively.
5 with this one.
You can retroactively give Yojimbo a 5.
Yeah, I think it deserves it. You know, I might throw a star back there, but I got to give this one 5 too. I really enjoyed this time round. Like I said, I think last time was a rehearsal. This is the show. Everyone's better in it. Music, direction, acting. Lee Van Cleef brings, you know, his presence to it. I'm going 5 with this one.
Zach?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with 4 out of $5. So it ties with the last film. On the strength of Lee Van Cleef, that balances out where I thought it might have been too long or dragged too much or gotten a little too convoluted in certain places. I totally see what all y'all are saying, but I felt like my enjoyment factor was pretty much on the same level as A Fistful of Dollars. So they're both $4 out of $5 for me. What about you, Brandon?
I'm definitely going 5 on this one here. The style of making, like Tom said, is better. They are on their A game here. There were so many moments in here. Like you just mentioned, I had forgotten about the poker scene. Was amazing. You know, the hat scene was amazing. You know, Lee Van Cleef's character with all his really cool contraptions. I think this is a really, really great movie, and I definitely would give this a 5.
Well, so. Lee Van Cleef also in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I believe he's the guy that shoots the needle that kills the Rhetosaurus at the end. So if people want to go see more Lee Van Cleef, go check out The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. From
it's all connected.
1953.
It's all connected.
So anyway. Well, Tom, the time has come then to ask our final question we do on this podcast. Is this franchise fatigue? So seeing the films we've seen now, would you want to see another one? Or are you like, yeah, we're done. We've said all we can with these characters in this story.
I think it's interesting, really, because there sometimes comes a point where you think, well, they've peaked, you know, maybe they shouldn't do another one. And it's not because I didn't enjoy it. It's just maybe that's a nice place to leave it. But I think considering how I feel about it in relation to the last one, like that was the rehearsal and this is the show. Now they've got their stuff together, I want to see more. So I'm saying no, it's not fatigued yet.
Mm-hmm. No, this one's definitely slept well and rested well. No longer fatigued. Definitely bright-eyed and bushy-tailed with this one, and I want to see where this character can go.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I feel like we've had a couple of solid movies from Clint Eastwood's character. I'm looking forward to a third film with a third name and a lot of actors we've seen in previous roles playing new roles in feature movies. That's what I'm looking forward to. So nose all
around. Not to mention, Zach, it's a three-hour film.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Should keep going with those threes. Third movie,
why is it
third
so
time?
Long? I don't know. I love longer films too. You know, I just felt like that's why. And you know, Yojimbo and Sanjiro both get those five out of five because I was like, these are brisk. They're tight. You know, they don't drag. Like they're to the point. Like so these are still good. I just feel like, you know, this one's weakness was a little long in my book. So your mileage may vary.
Awesome. Excellent. Right on. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. Can we count on you for part three?
Oh,
part
man,
five?
I wouldn't miss it just to see Zach after that three-hour movie. But yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it. Thanks for having me on again, guys.
Excellent. Where can people find you when you're not taking aim at somebody's hat?
Over at thetwilightzonepodcast.com.
Excellent. Zach, where can people find you when you're not bullying your way into a poker game?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Sold in the Smallville. We talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S. What about you, Brandon, when you're not sneaking up on people from behind and messing up their arithmetic at the end of the movie? That actually was a great moment.
Didn't know where that one was going.
Yeah, I know, right? But no, that's a great moment at the end of the movie. I just wanted to mention before we sign off here is when he's counting up all the dead bodies in the wagon, and he's like, oh, that's 10,000, 12,000, and then there's this one guy. I'm like, oh, man, if this was like a Martin Scorsese movie, this guy would have killed Clint Eastwood right there. That would have been just a very depressing ending. But it wasn't, and Eastwood heard him, and he turned around, and Lee Van Cleef's like, oh, have any trouble? And Eastwood's like, yeah, I'm having trouble with my math, but I got it figured out now. So anyway, that's what I was going for there. Where can people find you, Brandon? Basically, that's the question. So,
you can find me on one Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me two on the Alfred. Is it two? Is that two? Yeah, my math's doing better.
There it is. Tying it together.
Good evening. Good evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with my friends Chris and Tom. There we cover all of the Hitchcock films. And yeah, over on Trek FM, I have a show called The Line with my friends Chrissy and Justin. And over there, we talk about all the wonderful things leading up to Star Trek Picard coming out January 23rd, right away here. So it's a lot of fun. Check out our episode 8, which has recently released, where we actually compare, you know, what we think might happen with Star Trek Picard's character, and we compare it to Logan, the movie Logan. So that was kind of fun. I got to see that for the first time.
It does seem like the same plot.
Something like that. So excellent. Well, that's all we got for you today. So thank you so much to Zach Tripp for creating our wonderful theme song music. Thanks to Tony Robinson and Ken Tripp for being executive producers here on the network. Please share our posts. That helps us out more than you could possibly know. Please give us a rating and review in iTunes or wherever you subscribe. And if you want to support us through Patreon, you can find us at patreon.com/UFP Earth. You can find the network on Facebook. Just search United Federation of Podcasts, Twitter at UFP Earth, and you can email us contact@UFP.Earth. So until next time, when we've got the good, the bad, and the ugly. Adios, amigos.
Sayonara.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.